Hello, welcome. My name is David McDonald. I'm here with my colleagues Chris Cahoon, Claudia Hauer, and Sarah Stickney, and we mean to talk about Homer. And after we've each spoken about Homer, we'd like to have a conversation with you. So the format tonight will be this, that we will each speak, and then there'll be a very brief break, and then we'll come back. That break will be short enough that we don't lose momentum from everything that will have happened while we're speaking, which is going to be totally spellbinding. And so we'll come back and we'll have a conversation where we're all talking about Homer together. So let's get started. Thank you. There are refreshments in the hallway, but what we're asking is that you get those fairly quickly, and because we don't want to have too long of a pause. But by all means, go get something to refresh yourself during the break. So here we go.
Hi, everyone. So nice to see all of you on this evening of Zozobra. This is better than burning. As good. Just to add one more thing to the question period thing, especially for those of you who are kind of new to the community, the idea, at least as I have understood it, is that the lecture is for the question period. And the question period is as open a forum as you can imagine. So, you know, once you've finished your first cookie, you can go get another one and then come back, you know. You can stay all night, you can leave and come back in an hour and see if we're still here and we're saying more interesting things. But it's we speak so that we may speak with you afterwards. Okay, I'm gonna read you a passage from the beginning of book 12 of the Iliad and then try to notice some things about it. I think one of the delights of being part of this community is the immense pleasure we take in coming together to notice things with each other. It is one of the most enjoyable ways I know to learn, and one of the most effective. It is also a deeply relational practice, a way to enjoy others' company, to find friendship, and to practice being with people who have opinions and habits that differ greatly from our own. Noticing together may sometimes feel insignificant, like, is it worth talking about what breathless length means for this long of a time? But I am convinced that the practice of noticing is the sleekest of rocket ships for getting out into the wild and other dimensional territory that attracts many of us to thinking. The more we learn to notice in one particular area, the more we will see in any realm. So that reading a poem might help us see a sculpture better. Drawing a dissection in lab might change the way we see a math proposition, and demonstrating a math proposition might change the way we read a poem. One image I've started to use to describe what noticing does is to turn on the lights of things. If you're taking a walk and the person you're with points out a blooming wildflower you hadn't seen, one little light gets turned on. If the two of you take walks often together and with others, you will start understanding how to look for where wildflowers like to grow and when they like to bloom, and you might end up illuminating whole mountainsides. I get to take so many pleasurable walks uphill and down dale of these books with you, and I am still learning new ways of noticing from my colleagues and students all the time. In honor of the beginning of the school year, and the first book that we read at this college, I hope to demonstrate some small portion of the possible range of noticing. So, first I'll read the text, which is about the first page of book 12. And if you don't remember who the strong son of Menoetius is, it's Patroclus. While the strong son of Menoetius was ministering to Eurypylus in the huts and tending his wound, the battle raged on between the great masses of the Argives and Trojans, and the trench of the Danaans with the wide wall beyond it were not going to hold out much longer. They had built the wall to protect the ships and dug the trench around the wall, but they had not offered splendid hundredfold sacrifices to the gods. Their aim was to keep their swift ships safe, with all the spoils they had within them, but they built their defenses against the will of the immortal gods, and they couldn't remain intact for very long. So long as Hector was alive and Achilles was wrapped up in his wrath and the city of Lord Priam held out against all attempts to destroy it, for so long did the great wall of the Achaeans remain in one piece. But when all the bravest fighters among the Trojans had been killed off, and many of the Argives too were brought down, though some survived, when Priam's city was laid waste in the 10th year of the war, and the Argives had departed in their ships for their dear native lands, Poseidon and Apollo at last joined forces to soften up and collapse the wall by bringing to bear against it the combined power of all the rivers that pour forth from the mountain range of Ida and down to the sea. The Rhesus and the Heptapterus and the Carasus and the Rhodius and the Granicus and the Aesepus and the immortal Scamander and the Simois, beside which so many leather shields and helmets dropped into the dust, along with a race of men who were demigods. Phoebus Apollo diverted the mouths of all these rivers into a single channel, and for 9 days let the torrent pound the wall, while Zeus sent constant rains to sweep the ramparts out to sea all the sooner. The god who makes the earth quake with his trident in hand led the work himself, guiding out onto the waves all the foundation blocks of wood and stone the Achaeans had labored to lay down, and smoothing over the ground beside the strong current of the Hellespont. Then he covered up the vast beach once again with sand, and now that the wall was gone, he turned the rivers back to flow in the courses where their lovely waters had run before. So, one thing to notice is that book 12, of which this passage is the beginning, appears right in the middle of the poem numerically, 24 books. It is much quieter and more still than much of the poem, certainly quieter than the scenes of battle so bloody they still manage to shock us, even though we've worked so hard in movies and books to render such shock impossible. Because of its position in the center of the poem, and because of its relative stillness, I am thinking of this passage like the top of an arch. In the movement of an arch, the keystone constitutes a kind of resting point, a moment of balance and stillness. Part of what causes this resting point is what I'll call zooming out. In the Iliad, we are often so close to the action that we see eyeballs pop out of people's heads. We hear when friends whisper, and we feel the shaking of the earth as men march. Here, the poet backs out of the scene so far, we can even see the future. This broadening of the lens causes a couple things to happen. For one thing, it shrinks the importance of the present. Huge Achilles becomes tiny, the sturdy city of Troy insignificant, the concerns of the Achaeans unimportant. This alone changes our relationship to the poem. The people that my heart had been beating hard for just moments earlier are now strangely distant. The thing that I thought I was supposed to pay attention to, what's going to happen here, no longer seems central. The effect becomes even more extreme because in this passage, the poem destroys much of what it has made. I'll read a part of the passage again. But when all the bravest fighters among the Trojans had been killed off, and many of the Argives too were brought down, when Priam's city was laid waste in the 10th year of the war, and the Argives had departed in their ships for their dear native lands. Talk about a spoiler. We learn that Troy falls, that the Achaeans go back home, and that practically no trace remains. This suggests that I might have to look for other ways to understand what is most central to the poem. If it's not about finding out who dies and who wins, what is it about? Here, obviously, we could insert a lifetime's worth of thinking and wondering, and maybe we can talk together a little bit about it during question period. I have a thought. I had that experience writing this where you realize towards the end of writing it that you have thought of the thing that would be better to write about. That's right there, but we'll move on. For now, I'll just point out that the poet in this place undermines the centrality of plot. Speaking of plot, however, there's another aspect of this keystone moment I want to touch on. At the end of book 11, Patroclus is attempting to heal Eurypylus in his tent. We won't return to Patroclus in this moment until book 15, but it is the conversation that causes Patroclus to suggest to Achilles at the beginning of book 16 that he go into battle in Achilles' stead. Plot-wise and heart-wise, it seems to me that that is the most powerful move of the book, and it is the thing that will cause the rest of the plot to unravel. Thus, this moment of stillness in book 12 comes just one moment before Patroclus will pull the end of the rope that will undo the knot of the war. I believe this knot is made manifest in the language of the passage. Reading once again. So long as Hector was alive, and Achilles was wrapped up in his wrath, and the city of Priam held out against all attempts to destroy it, for so long did the great wall of the Achaeans remain in one piece. You can feel all those aspects exerting pressure on each other, the way the stones of the arch exert pressure on the capstone. But when any one of them moves, they all tumble. And Patroclus, the healer, the diplomat, the listener, the heart friend, and the person who will end up killing more warriors than anyone else we hear of, is the one to make it move. Another shift that this passage causes to occur in what could be called the allegiance of the listener is that where there were the names of warriors, there are now the names of rivers. The names of men disappear, and the names of rivers rise into prominence. I think there are, in fact, quite a few places in both the Iliad and the Odyssey where the poet expresses resistance to what we now call the Anthropocene, and this is one of the places that strikes me most strongly. I love the image of Apollo, Zeus, and Poseidon working together to clean up the beach, though they were not on the same team during the war. The passage shows how great are the powers of the ocean, the rain, and the rivers. Quote, the god who makes the earth quake with his trident in hand led the work himself, guiding out onto the waves all the foundation blocks of wood and stone the Achaeans had labored to lay down, and smoothing over the ground beside the strong current of the Hellespont. Then he covered up the vast beach once again with sand. And now that the wall was gone, he turned the rivers back to flow in their courses where their lovely waters had run before. I love watching, you know, all that debris just float out onto the ocean and then the beach, you know, be completely restored. And all traces of this, you know, the greatest event so far in human history gone. Step by step, the poem dismantles all the man-made structures on the beach. When I read this, I experience a kind of relief, perhaps because there is something comforting in being shown that even the greatest of men are insignificant compared to the world we occupy and the span of time that surrounds us. I think this kind of move that this passage makes is really only possible in language. It is highly visual in one sense, and yet it is the kind of image that requires a particular imagination because of the simultaneity of the present and the future. The future is being laid down over the present of the poem. But even more than that, the future is undoing the present of the poem. I think this is analogous in some ways to what many of the similes do. The similes often move from the heat of a particular moment of battle to a quiet, contemplative scene of nature. I think another really good example is that snowing simile where you know, both sides are throwing these heavy stones at each other, and then you get this incredible simile of like thick snow falling, and it's falling on the mountains, and it's falling on the ocean, and it's so quiet, you know, and beautiful, and then you're back to these two sides throwing the heaviest stones, you know, they can find. I'm going to end with a digression. But thinking about this passage kept reminding me of a sentence towards the beginning of Virginia Woolf's novel, Mrs. Dalloway. Like the passage I've just read, the sentence destroys the whole world that the book is about to take place in. So I'm just going to read the sentence for fun. This is early on, and what's happening is that a motor car, a fancy motor car with somebody really important inside, has just passed on the street, but nobody knows who the important person is. Everybody's guessing. But there could be no doubt that greatness was seated within. Greatness was passing, hidden, down Bond Street, removed only by a hand's breadth from ordinary people, who might now, for the first and last time, be within speaking distance of the majesty of England, of the enduring symbol of the state, which will be known to curious antiquaries sifting the ruins of time when London is a grass-grown path and all those hurrying along the pavement this Wednesday morning are but bones with a few wedding rings mixed up in their dust and the gold stoppings of innumerable decayed teeth. So one of the questions I'm hoping to ask you in the question period is, what does it mean? Why do Wolfe and Homer both obliterate, at least for a moment, you know, in our imagination, the world that they've taken great pains to make? And I'll give one stab, which is one of the motifs of Mrs. Dalloway is certainly marriage. And it's interesting to me that the wedding rings are demoted, mentioned, but demoted to the dust of what was once London and is now just, you know, a barely visible path in the grass. And I wonder if one could suggest that war occupies a similar position in the Iliad. Namely, it looks like it's the thing most in the reader's attention, but in the end, no glory or lasting significance adheres to it.
Thank you, Ms. Stickney. I'm going to turn us to the Odyssey. I'm grateful to be invited to this panel. I have been wanting to try something out with a particular sequence in the Odyssey, and the panel format of a shorter talk is really inviting to me to try this out with you. This is the sequence of fantastical events that Odysseus narrates to the Phaeacians once they realize that he is the famous hero Odysseus. I thought it might be useful to lay out his sequence and look directly at it, as it deals with themes that evoke brutal and traumatic aspects of Odysseus's attempt over the first 3 years after leaving Troy to return home with his companions. I'll lay out the sequence for you, and then we can discuss some of the themes and tones that it contains. The tale that Odysseus narrates to the Phaeacians comprises books 9 through 12 of the Odyssey. The tale contains some of the most fantastic and strange aspects in all of Greek mythology. Odysseus narrates the tale as though it were simply or literally true. And yet it contains so many fantastical elements, I believe that it must conceal something as well, something about the terrible process of setting out to return to one's peaceful home from the horrors of combat, and thinking of Ms. Stickney's final words. The Odyssey is the story of how one of the warriors who went to Troy is actually able to navigate the terrible transition from the butchery of the Trojan War back to being home. Since Homer shows us other warriors who do not manage the transition very well, for example, Menelaus or Agamemnon, the tale warrants our attention as it details the difficulty in Odysseus's homecoming process in a phantasmagoric and mythic presentation. We read a lot of works about war and the mind of the warrior here in the freshman year. At the heart of the Iliad is the problem that the warrior of the greatest merit, Achilles, does not receive the greatest honor. The Greek word for warrior honor is timē, the honor earned in the forms of spoils of war. The discrepancy between a warrior's merit and the timē he is awarded by the powers that be is also explored later in the freshman year in Sophocles' tragedy, Ajax. It is a tale of betrayal. Another terrible warrior story is Sophocles' tragedy, Philoctetes, which explores the trauma of betrayal in a different form. The sequence narrated in Odysseus's tale to the Phaeacians is one of the most puzzling features of what is already a very complicated picture of Odysseus as a storyteller. At the beginning of the Odyssey, Odysseus is introduced with the adjective polutropos. This can be translated in several ways. Phagels translates it as the man of twists and turns, Lattimore as man of many ways, and Emily Wilson as a complicated man. A variation of this epithet is used of Odysseus again as he prepares to begin his tale to the Phaeacians at the beginning of Book 9, Polumetis. For this, Phagel settles on the great teller of tales. Lattimore uses resourceful Odysseus, and Emily Wilson tries the stronger phrase, Lord of Lies. We shouldn't get caught up in which of these translations we may like the best, or think the best, or even which is the best. There is so much mystery that surrounds the ancient Homeric dialect in which these epic tales were passed down from generation to generation orally in a period that predates by hundreds and possibly thousands of years the literary record of these epics that was written in the 5th century BCE. So rather than deciding what Polumetis means about Odysseus in this context, let's just hold it out there that Odysseus can tell a variety of tales in a variety of ways. The tale to the Phaeacians is unique, and that may be because the tale is delivered to a unique audience and may serve an unusual function even for the wily of Odysseus. Let's start with the tale, and then I'll return to these possibilities. First, a brief introduction. We learn in the Iliad Book 2, in what is called the Catalogue of Ships, that Odysseus led 12 ships to Troy, manned by around 600 men. They were mustered from Ithaca, Odysseus's home island, and other nearby islands such as Zakynthos and Same, off the northwestern mainland. They are called the Cephallenians. In the tale to the Phaeacians, Odysseus narrates a sequence of somewhere between 11 and 12 events, or episodes, that occur after he and his 12 ships and approximately 600 men sail away from Troy at the end of the 10 years' war. I will break them down into 11 episodes that occur prior to his leaving Calypso's island on the little raft. First, the men sack the city of the Kikones in a place called Ismaris. Odysseus describes how they sacked the town, killed all the men, and took all their wives. Odysseus urges his men to leave, but they were obliviously partying on the beach with all the plunder. Somehow, the Kikones managed to summon their mainland neighbors. It's not clear who does the summoning, since Odysseus has claimed to have killed the men and took the wives. But the neighbors come and attack. Homer has Odysseus say, six well-armed members of my crew died from each ship. So now a total of 72 men have died. In the second event, the ships are blown off course by a north wind typhoon and are swept for 9 days until they arrive at the land of the Lotus Eaters. Odysseus's scouts eat the lotus and forget their homes. Odysseus forces them back onto the ships, despite their tears, and ties them up to keep them on board. So now the theme of forgetting one's home has been introduced into this tale of returning from war. The third episode is the visit to the Cyclops, who eats two each of Odysseus's men for dinner on the 2 days that Odysseus remains in the cave before Odysseus manages to gouge out the Cyclops' eye, get his men out of the cave by tying them two each to the bellies of the giant sheep, and performs the linguistic trick of telling the Cyclops that his name is No Man. In this episode, the themes of cannibalism and of becoming no one have been introduced into the narrative of returning from war, and four more men have died. In the fourth episode, Odysseus and his men feast in the home of Aeolus, king of the winds, for 1 month. When they leave, they are almost home when Odysseus's men open Aeolus's gift of the bag of winds, and they are blown back to Aeolus's island. Instead of receiving them a second time, Aeolus curses them and drives them off. The next episode happens at the Lystragonian town of Telepolis on the cliffs of Lamos. Here, Odysseus and his comrades run into giants, who spear an unspecified number of Odysseus's men like fish and eat them. Odysseus escapes with only one ship left of the 12. Cannibalism again, more giants, and a lot more men lost. The sixth episode is the visit to Circe, daughter of the sun, who turns half of the remaining men into pigs. Odysseus meets the god Hermes, who gives him the antidote to Circe's pig spell, and so Odysseus is able to have sex with Circe and get her to remove the pig spell from the other men. The men end up staying on her island for 1 year, feasting and resting, until Circe tells Odysseus he will have to visit the underworld if he wants to complete his homecoming for more. The seventh episode is the trip to the underworld, narrated in Book 11. Trips to the underworld are a common theme in warrior homecoming mythologies. Virgil has one in the Aeneid, and they are also a common theme in Asian and Native American homecoming from war narratives. It is easy to see in them some deeply human spiritual requisite that the returning warrior must find a way to visit with the spirits of those who did not survive the war. Odysseus continues this tale with a brief eighth episode in which his men return to Circe's isle in order to bury Elpenor, and where Circe gives Odysseus crucial information on the Sirens and on Scylla and Charybdis. A ninth episode is the trip past the Sirens. Odysseus orders his men to bind him to a mast and forces the rest to plug their ears with wax. Despite Odysseus' own longing to stay with the Sirens, after hearing their song, the whole ship makes it safely past the enticing Sirens due to the stratagem suggested by Circe. The 10th episode involves navigating the dual threats of Scylla and Charybdis, with all of their obvious symbolism that evokes fear of the feminine. While Odysseus' men are riveted by Scylla's sucking down the water, Charybdis snatches Odysseus' six best men, who heart-rendingly cry out to Odysseus as they are snatched up to their death. In the final episode, Odysseus narrates how all the rest of his men, except him, ate the forbidden cattle of the sun god, and Zeus, in retribution, blasts Odysseus' ship as it sails away from the island of the sun god. Only Odysseus, clinging to a floating timber, survives, washing up on Calypso's isle, where he stays 7 years, before making it to Phaeacia, at first via the homemade raft, and secondly via the swim to the rocks that my colleague Chris Cahoon will discuss. By setting out these 11 episodes in this manner, I have been able to focus in on a few themes that appear in many cultural traditions of narrating a warrior's process of returning from war. Some of these are the likelihood that the warrior will have trouble relinquishing the violence and violent impulses that have been a form of survival in combat. The possibility that the warrior may not want to return home and prefer a life listening to a siren song or living with a spirit woman. The possibility that a warrior might not be able to envision himself as fully human, and maybe will see himself as having become an animal and fallen out of human speech. The need to find a way to commune with the spirits of those who did not survive the war. The possibility that one has incurred some kind of divine wrath for which only death can atone. The possibility that one carries incomprehensible sorrow that he was not able to bring his comrades home. All of these themes lurk around this tale that Odysseus tells the Phaeacians. One reason that the Odyssey remains such a timely tale, and it is important to avoid identifying it primarily as a literary text, since it was promulgated orally during the period in which it was most fully a living tale, and was only written down in the time of Pericles, as chronicled by Thucydides, is that it is concerned with the perennial problem of bringing a warrior home from combat with his spiritual, moral, and psychological humanity intact. This appears to be a universal and timeless problem. The Native Americans have a community ritual for their returning warriors. They do not let them enter the village until they have performed a ritual cleansing them of the terrible things they may have had to do, and pronouncing them fit to leave the horror of war and re-enter the village of moral, peaceful community life. This particular sequence that Odysseus tells the spellbound Phaeacians seems to me to have some analogous ritualistic dimension, speaking to Odysseus's understanding of the traumatic issues that surround warrior homecoming. The Phaeacians are a peaceful people. They love to hear war stories, but they don't seem to ever experience combat themselves. Is it possible that Odysseus felt himself able to reveal some of the more unspeakable, horrific components of the journey home, albeit cloaked in the mythology of the fantastic, because he recognized that cloaked in that form, the Phaeacians would hear it as a fantastic tale and not read more into it? Such a tale would serve two purposes. First, it might be therapeutic for Odysseus to put some of the unspeakable trauma he may have endured into human speech by redirecting it as the polumetis speaker that he is toward the fantastic and the mythic. Secondly, Odysseus's endgame is to get the Phaeacians to ferry him to his home of Ithaca. If the Phaeacians are enthralled by this crazy story, they may be more inclined to view Odysseus's request as a favor they can grant in return for this wild night of entertainment. The Phaeacians do ferry Odysseus home at their own peril, as it turns out, for they have forgotten a prophecy given to Alcinous's father, suggesting that they will face terrible retribution for what appears to be a simple courtesy. However, Homer cuts their story short in order to begin Book 13 to focus on the practical, if also violent, matters that Odysseus has to undertake on Ithaca in order to make his home into a place where he can be fully home from war, truly at home, in all of the human dimensions that entail morality, mental health, and the capacity for love and intimacy that seem to elude so many of his fellow warriors from the Trojan War experience. Returning to the mysterious epithet polumetis, is it possible that Odysseus somehow finds a way to speak about things that the warrior recognizes are unspeakable by redirecting the horrors he has experienced into symbols of myth and fantasy that can hold these horrors somehow true to their shape while avoiding the curse that would surely arise if they were spoken of in ordinary human language, bound as it is by the ethical bonds acceptable within community? Odysseus's other made-up stories in the Odyssey are all plausible. They stay within the bounds of what we might think of as the rhetorical function of language. The tale to the Phaeacians stands out. Although we hear about his time on Calypso's island in books 1 and 5, this is the only report we get of the first 3 years of Odysseus's journey home. Because all of his comrades are lost, he is the only witness. I wonder if we who hear this tale are ourselves bearing witness to a most unusual form of language, used almost ritualistically, perhaps therapeutically, for giving voice to unspeakable horrors and told to a community that will accept the narrative as myth and leave the deeper meaning unprobed. I'll stop here and thank you for the opportunity to share this.
So I'm already seeing connections to what my colleagues, between what my colleagues have just said and what I'm about to say, which also has to do with water and wounds. So toward the end of book five, by the way, you have a handout that will be linked to this. And if you don't yet have one and would like one, there's a few extras on the chair toward the front over there to my left. So toward the end of book five of the Odyssey, Homer formulates a mind-bending simile that has always obsessed me. It involves an octopus. It involves Odysseus's skin. And it involves us, I think, in a central question in the poem about Odysseus's identity. When Odysseus returns home, exactly who returns home? So I want to look at this simile, but I know that some of us have not yet read the Odyssey. So let me first set the scene a little bit. After ultimately losing all ships and crew during his meandering homeward journey following the Trojan War, Odysseus washes up alone on Ogygia, the island of the immortal cave nymph Calypso. Calypso, whose name means "I will conceal," intends to keep this fabulous man as an erotic captive for all time. It's not a bad deal for him. Her beauty is exquisite, and his life becomes immortal under her gaze. And yet, longing for home, Odysseus is miserable in this oddly dull paradise. Finally, after 7 years, his divine protector Athena prevails upon Zeus, who orders that Calypso release Odysseus to resume his homecoming voyage to his island kingdom Ithaca and wife Penelope, both now precarious. Odysseus sets out on a raft for Scheria, the island whose inhabitants, the Phaeacians, are fated to ferry him safely home. But just as he catches a glimpse of Scheria, Odysseus is detected by the vengeful Poseidon, still mad about his blinded son, the Cyclops Polyphemus. The Earthshaker god hurls storms at the raft, splintering it. Having just escaped the divine oblivion of deathless life on Calypso's island, Odysseus now finds himself facing the liquid oblivion of a death in the elemental depths. His mind races back to war. Better to have died in Troy and won a glorious name there, Kleos, he thinks. Nothing is worse than namelessness. Intervening directly now, Athena steers the winds to blow Odysseus to the Scyrian coast. Yet he finds no hospitable coves, only cliffs and crags. Suddenly, a heavy surge flings him toward the jagged rocks, thanks to Poseidon. This really would have been the end of resourceful Odysseus, said Homer. And here I'm going to continue on your handout. His skin would have been taken off, his bones crushed altogether, had not the gray-eyed goddess Athena sent him an inkling. And he frantically caught hold with both hands on the rock face and clung to it, groaning, until the great wave went over. This one he so escaped. But the backwash of the same wave caught him where he clung and threw him far out into the open water. Now here comes the simile, which isolates just this moment as Odysseus is sucked out of the cavern. As when an octopus is dragged away from its shelter, the thickly clustered pebbles stick in the cups of the tentacles, so, in contact with the rock, the skin from his bold hands was torn away. Now the great sea covered him over. The word for covering over is kalupsein. Odysseus will survive, but barely. His very heart, sick with seawater, he could neither breathe nor speak, says Homer. As book five closes, after Odysseus staggers up the estuary banks and into a grove, Athena covers his exhausted eyes with a veil of sleep, an image that suggests both death and rebirth. In the morning, he will awaken, naked, to find the Phaeacian princess Nausicaa doing laundry in the river. Soon, she will introduce him to her royal parents, who are eager to know his identity. Okay, let's look more closely at the simile now, which, as always in Homer, holds up something to really see. There are two images overlaid in a strange togetherness. As the octopus, dragged from its nook by a fisherman, takes bits of rock with it, says Homer, so Odysseus, swept back out to sea by a wave, leaves behind bits of skin on the rock. What do we see? What is the point of contact between the octopus and Odysseus? To begin with, the Greek word for octopus is polypodos, multi-footed, which echoes Odysseus's many poly-prefixed epithets, polytropos, polytules, polymetis. We see Odysseus as octopus-like here, multiplicitous and dexterous. At the core of this comparison between the polypodic animal and the polytropic hero, though, is their plastic tenacity in the face of death. The tenacity is hyperbolic, really, to the point of altering the environment. As the octopus excavates the rock, so bits of Odysseus's ultra-human grip remain on the rock. Yet, as we look at the simile's two images together, we're already beginning to see points of vivid difference. The simile brims with inversion. One has feet, the other has heroic hands. One dies on land, the other craves it. The crucial inversion, though, concerns the economics. Whereas the octopus takes rock fragments off the cavern wall, Odysseus leaves skin on it. I'm tempted to see the octopus as a figure of resistance. If you want to eat me, it says, you'll have to take the rock wall too. One imagines a grumpy fisherman later having to pick rocks out of the suckers. Little consolation for the octopus, but nonetheless a certain gain. By contrast, Odysseus loses something, an unexpected turn for the character famous for his adaptive endurance and whose signature move is emerging unscathed. I think this loss is significant. These are the only skin-breaking wounds Odysseus receives in his Odyssey, unless we count the famous scar, but more on that in a minute. It may seem that in evoking Odysseus's great, bold hands, the simile straightforwardly heroicizes this moment. Yet the image it presents simultaneously depicts the inadequacy of the hero to this moment. The heroic gesture, inspired by Athena as Poseidon's wave rushes Odysseus coastward, is to seize a handhold at the very instant his sea-thrown body hits the rocks. And yet, it belongs to the nature of the seacoast that the movement of its waves is double. The waves advance and they recede. The poet emphasizes this duality in having it be the backwash of the same wave that pulls Odysseus back out. If Athena had not inspired Odysseus's great hands on the wave's powerful advance, his skin would have been altogether torn off, Homer tells us. Yet in the wave's violent recession, which I take to be the side of Poseidon's power that exceeds Athena's reach, there is some tearing off of skin after all, says Homer, using the same verb, apodrupto. And it is the skin of these same great hands. Something is left behind then. It's as though the hero's identity is itself wounded, depleted, held open. If, as the proem states, the adventuring Odysseus aims in some sense to achieve his psuche, which certainly means his literal life, but which also suggests his very identity, then what role does the wound play in this storyline? The predominant thread of the Odyssey's complex plot is the restoration storyline, the Nostos. Post-war Odysseus is lost. He's far from Ithaca, and Ithaca is far gone without him. The goal, overseen on the divine side by Athena, is to return to and restore both self and home. If the victory at Troy layered onto Odysseus pride and ambition for greater fame and booty, the homecoming journey serves to peel it off bit by bit. His self-restoration initially takes the form of a certain stripping bare, one Poseidon's destructive wrath partly serves, but which Athena seeks to limit. It's a question of nakedness. In the adventure tales of the central books, ship and crew gradually and disturbingly fall away until only much enduring Odysseus remains alone. His near-fatal journey from Ogygia to Scheria goes further. Having lost his raft and clothes, he arrives on Scheria, the last stop before home, utterly naked. Yet what the simile of the torn skin uncovers is that Odysseus is here not merely naked. He has lost more than ship's crew and clothes. Why does the stripping bare go this far, to the point of Odysseus becoming more than naked? Why does this climactic moment of his self-restoration culminate in self-depletion? I call this moment climactic because in Odysseus's trip from Ogygia to Scheria, the first island that promotes his homecoming rather than delaying it, we see a transition from Poseidon's wrath to Athena's resumed sponsorship. Poseidon unleashes his final torment, and Athena intervenes for the first time in a decade. Yet, in the duality of that storm wave, where Athena supports on the advance and Poseidon complicates in the retreat, I've been recognizing the uneasy boundary between the two divine projects. Imagery of rebirth is ubiquitous in books 5 and 6 and elsewhere, not least of all in Odysseus's naked skin. But this now torn skin is not untouched by death.
If thanks to Poseidon, Odysseus's self-restorative stripping away goes beyond the boundaries of his skin, then this means that Athena's restoration plot is somehow indecisive, troubled by a countervailing Poseidon strain. Athena does get Odysseus home, but Poseidon takes a cut. The wounds themselves surely heal, but their meaning lingers. Will the Odysseus who is about to return be recognizable as himself? Yes and no. Here it's interesting to contrast these wounds with Odysseus's famous scar. As we learn in a flashback, a 20-year-old Odysseus won the scar bravely battling a wild boar, thus coming of age as a young hero and earning recognition from his maternal grandfather, Autolycus. That scar, too, resulted from a non-fatal wound, but it bears a different relation to Odysseus's identity. In the shredded hands, we see an image of heroic identity diminished. The scar, by contrast, marks an achievement and one that became emblematic of his identity. When disguised as a beggar in Ithaca, he'll flash that scar like ID to his herdsmen Eumaeus and Philoetius and to his father Laertes. And of course, his old nurse Eurycleia famously spots it prematurely. With Penelope, though, things are different. In the buildup to the famous recognition scene in book 23, Penelope is surprisingly uninterested in the scar. When Eurycleia reports the scar sighting to her, Penelope just doesn't believe her. Nor does she engineer a way to see it for herself. Why not? It's as though there's a little bit of Poseidon in her. She wants the wound. Growing impatient for recognition at this point, Odysseus calls her Daimonia, strange, inscrutable, unrecognizable, and petulantly asks for a single bed. Calling him Daimonia in return and seeking to test Odysseus, Penelope casually asks the nurse to bring their marriage bed outside the bedroom, a bed whose frame was integrated with a living tree, as Odysseus alone knows. Deeply hurt by the thought that their marriage bed had been uprooted, Odysseus explodes into rage. Only then, when he shows himself precisely as wounded, does Penelope speak his name, now in the vocative. In contrast to his powerful self-revelation to the Phaeacians, to Polyphemus, or to the suitors in the Great Hall, here Odysseus is revealed passively. Indeed, he passes Penelope's test precisely in being revealed as something other than himself. That is, not at all as the typically strategic and self-controlled Odysseus. Insofar as Odysseus, the master trickster, was supposed to be the one testing her, Penelope, to rule out any Clytemnestra-style shenanigans, one might even say that Penelope usurps his identity here. Who then has been recognized in this moment? Athena's restoration narrative succeeded most vividly in the public sphere. Odysseus is recognized, either by his scar or, for the suitors in the Great Hall, by the prowess it represents. Yet the Poseidon plot, whose destructive goals pursued Odysseus all the way beneath the boundaries of his most naked identity, persists in many ways in Ithaca, some of them violent, but perhaps most vividly and creatively in the private, erotic spaces. Might this plot perhaps even shine a little retrospective light, on Odysseus's choice of Penelope over Calypso? On Ogygia, Odysseus was ensnared by a divine lover whose immortal perfection was a known entity, and in whose perspective Odysseus's own identity was immobilized as the fine mortal specimen she wanted to possess forever, as though he were a work of art. But at home in Ithaca with Penelope, who refuses both to let Odysseus be identified by his scar and to let him know exactly what she's thinking as their playful reunion unfolds, Odysseus discovers the attraction of being known in a way that is no longer a matter of identity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cahoon. So I'm going to turn to depths of a different kind And the question I had in the background as I thought about giving this talk was this. How is it fitting that the very first books we read are the books of Homer? How is that fitting for this education? In what way do these particular books get us started properly for what we'll go on to do for 4 years? And where I'm going to start, oddly, is on the topic of deception. Homer's world, the world that we see in the Iliad and the Odyssey, and I'm assuming they're the same world, is a world where deception is possible. It is possible to be deceived in those worlds. So, for example, when Odysseus is disguised as a beggar, he ceases to be the person who would be recognized, and he's dressed up. So this is how Athena describes that. Up now, quickly. First I will transform you. No one must know you. I will shrivel the supple skin on your lithe limbs, strip the russet curls from your head, and deck you out in rags you'd hate to see some other mortal wear. I'll dim the fire in your eyes, so shining once, until you seem appalling to all those suitors, even your wife and son you left behind at home. So that's deception. That's a setup for the being deceived of others. And it's done with the help of a god. Another similar episode, similar in that the gods are facilitating deception, is the one where Agamemnon is sent a dream, and this is an effort to sort of gin up the war. So the dream speaks to Agamemnon as he sleeps. This is in book two of the Iliad. And after the dream goes, we have this. With the dream departed, leaving him there, his heart racing with hopes that would not come to pass, he thought he would take the city of Priam then, that very day, the fool. How could he know what work the father had in mind? The father, still bent on plaguing the Argives and Trojans both with wounds and groans in the bloody press of battle. How could he know? So he himself is deceived by this dream. The dream is important for propelling the war. The war's gonna have to go on. But another instance of deception. So we have a world in which one can be mistaken. Now, why would that matter? Why is it important that we could be mistaken? If one does not have a world in which mistakes are possible, there's no inquiry that can be undertaken. There's nothing to inquire into if all is visible. And what we have in Homer is a world of multiple levels, where there's the world of humans, the world of men, and in that world, many things can be apprehended directly, but there are other levels. There's the realm of the gods. There may also be a realm of fate, which is not quite the same as that of the gods. So it might be at least a three-story world. And between those stories, between those levels, there's communication, there's action, there's intervention. There are gods impersonating people. There are omens sent, there are dreams sent. The gods influence the actions of the humans. And what this means from the human point of view is that there are many things that will be dimly understood or misunderstood. There will be deception. This is in contrast to the view of the world that many of us, or certainly many people contemporary to us are prone to have, which is a flat world. So that would be a world in which everything is visible. Everything is in principle knowable or known. You've got the doctrine, and there may be small incidental things that aren't quite clear to you, but everything important is already yours. So that's the sort of world, flat world, in which there's no depth and nothing to look into. So part of what Homer does for us as one of our first teachers here is to show us what it looks like to have a multi-level world, a world in which there are things going on that are not directly apprehended by us. And what that foreshadows or prepares the ground for is philosophy. The sort of inquiry that we see with Socrates in the dialogues of Plato is one where Socrates asks, what is it? Or what is beyond what we see? And those sorts of questions presuppose a world structured something like the Homeric world. And those sorts of questions are impossible in a world where only one plane is present and where only one sort of causality operates. But once you grant or assume or allow that there could be realms not entirely accessible to us, only intermittently seen by us, in which other kinds of causes operate, other sorts of agents are present, then inquiry is possible. So I'm inclined to see Homer, the works of Homer, as proto-philosophic. One way to think about what it means to have a multi-story world is in terms of depth. I think here we sometimes invoke depth and depth becomes a way of praising a work or a person. I think what it means for a work to be deep is precisely that it has this multi-level quality, where it operates on multiple levels, and where not everything is apparent. There's some degree of hiddenness or mystery, such that not everything is immediately seen, and that there could be spheres in which the work is operating that will be difficult to discover. They're not going to be obvious. And depth in person seems to have something to do with the ability to be responsive to that sort of depth in the work, and also to have levels inwardly. This is present in Homer. The persons in Homer often have this sort of depth. Odysseus is a prominent example of someone who is like that. But in the Iliad, too, we see characters who are not entirely known to themselves, and it implies that there are levels of personhood which are not continuously available even to the person concerned. This kind of thing becomes more explicit in Augustine, in the Confessions, but already this sense of depth in personhood is present in Homer. And we have a world in which depth is possible. So for us who live in an era where flattening seems to be a prevailing tendency, to begin with something that shows us the possibility of depth and shows us multiple levels of operation and connections between them, it's a sort of perfect initial pedagogy for us. I won't go too much longer because I want to get to the discussion, but I want to mention the similes that others have described and which are so central to our experience as we read these books. It follows from having put forward a multi-level world that resemblances are going to matter. The similarities between different levels of experience or different levels of reality, different kinds of beings, so that you can have agricultural metaphors or agricultural images invoked in describing battle, or you can have wild creatures used, like the bees streaming out as an image of the warriors coming out. So we have two different realms, two different levels of reality. One is the natural non-human world, and the other is the human world, those being connected through a simile. These correspondences, which we have in the works of Homer, they too are a kind of school for us, and giving us some of the basic tools for thinking. Because it turns out, this is my view, that nearly every important kind of thinking involves finding similitudes, finding resemblances. So this applies in philosophy. When you read Plato, so much of the thinking is in terms of images, or saying, well, suppose it's something like this, suppose it's like that. Science is similar, that there are many areas, domains, where there is no direct access to the thing being spoken of, and so some sort of image has to be used. So much of the world of science is invisible, and we use some kind of image. We say, well, it's kind of like a little chunk, or it's kind of like a wave, but we don't have the kind of access that would allow us to say that that's a direct description. It's a simile. So to be able to think in similitudes is necessary for thinking, and what we need to learn to do is to judge those likenesses appropriately, to not liken things which ought not to be likened, and to not fail to see similarities where they occur. So this is my brief account of why we begin with Homer, that he's providing us with a sense of world that will be necessary for thinking, and a kind of remedy for the flatness that is otherwise a kind of affliction for us. It makes it hard to think well, and that these levels, the resemblances among levels, are a very kind of important training for us in spotting similarities. So I'll just close with one question, which would be what it would take to preserve or cultivate a sense of dimensionality in the present era. It seems to me that education of this sort has to be part of that, but it seems to me it's such a deep difficulty that it doesn't seem to me to be simply a matter of it seems to me whatever the causes are, they're deeper. So that's one question, is what the causes are. So I'll finish there. Thank you.